Last month, Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts gave a commencement speech at his son's ninth grade graduation from a very prestigious school for boys in New England. And it's been bouncing around the internet because it was so thoughtful and insightful. He said, "From time to time in years to come, I hope you will be treated unfairly so that you will come to know the value of justice. I hope you will suffer betrayal because that will teach you the importance of loyalty. Sorry to say, but I hope you will be lonely from time to time so that you don't take friends for granted. I wish you bad luck, again, from time to time, so you will be conscious of the role of chance in life and understand that your success is not completely deserved and that the failure of others is not completely deserved either. And when you lose, as you will from time to time, I hope every now and then your opponent will gloat over your failure. It is a way for you to understand the importance of sportsmanship. I hope you will be ignored so that you know the importance of listening to others. And I hope you will have just enough pain to learn compassion." Well, wouldn't it be nice if we could order nothing but pleasant experiences and agreeable people in our lives all the time? Fun, fun, fun. But life's not that way. We do have many choices in our lives, but we can't choose everything that happens. I can never forget a Peanuts cartoon when Charlie Brown explains to Lucy, who is being crabby, as she often was, "Life is full of ups and downs." And Lucy said, "I don't want ups and downs. I want ups and ups and ups." Someone once tried to persuade cynical humorist Dorothy Parker, after she had had a bad romantic breakup, that life is sweet and wonderful. And she wrote this verse: "Oh, life is a cycle of glorious song, a medley of extemporanea, and love is a thing that can never go wrong." Right. And I am the queen of Romania. Sometimes life does stink. In John Roberts' commencement speech, he doesn't wish truly horrible things for those graduates, just a bit of unfair treatment, betrayal, loneliness, bad luck, and pain. Do you remember dealing with those? It can feel like the end of the world. Looking back on my life, I've dealt with hurts like that in several ways. One is good old denial. Either grow numb, or just put the memory of the event and the feelings in a sort of mental box and pretend for as long as possible that it never happened. Or I distract myself from thinking about it with an escape book or even a video game, or many. Or I try to mentally rewrite history, like in politics, put spin on it, to preserve the illusion that my life is so good and I don't have to change. Another way is to just let the experience defeat me, make me cynical and hard, or to feel like a victim, complaining a lot, looking for sympathy, and I decide that life is so bad. I tell you, I've done them all. But listen to Justice Roberts' words: "So that you will understand, so you will be conscious of, so you will know the importance of." Roberts didn't want these graduates' lives to turn out badly. He wanted them to accept and understand their negative experiences in order to become mature human beings. He went on, "Whether I wish these things or not, they're going to happen. Whether you benefit from them or not will depend on your ability to see the message in your misfortunes." He went on, "In a certain sense, you should not be yourself. You should try to become something better." People say, "Be yourself," because they want you to resist the impulse to conform to what others want you to be. But you can't be yourself if you don't learn who you are. And you can't learn who you are unless you think about it. "Just do it," Roberts went on. Might be a good motto for some things, but it's not a good motto when you're trying to figure out how to live your life that is before you. One important clue to living a good life is not try to live the best life, as it is defined by some people. The best way to lose the values that are central to who you are is, frankly, You lose them when you don't think about them at all, end quote. Rubbing up against reality is not fun. It's work. Justice Roberts is reminding them to do that work. That work is something we often refer to in UU endeavors. It's more than mindfulness, which is mostly being aware in the moment and paying attention. It's self-awareness, it's introspection, it's paying attention to context, and it's being willing and able to change yourself. Not easy stuff. While working on this reflection, I saw a positive experience become absorbed in a thoughtful, rather introspective way. My granddaughter Coco was here from DC last weekend, and at almost 4, is old enough to really play with her cousins, ages 6 and 8. They spent time together and they bonded. Coco is, and I assure you this with all the objectivity of a grandmother, amazingly observant and articulate. She talks nearly all the time, so it's not hard to understand what's going on in her mind. She doesn't have filters. I nudged it by reading to her Cynthia Ryland's book called The Relatives Came. Cynthia Ryland used to live in Kent. In the book, the aunts and uncles and cousins get up at 4 a.m. and they drive a long way and they arrive. Everybody tumbles out of the car and hugs everybody. The book says, you couldn't walk across the living room without being hugged 8 times. I saw Coco learn what it means to have cousins, to really take that into who she is. All the delights of siblings without the rivalry. I've loved my cousins. I've watched my kids and their cousins. And to me, it's one of the blessings of life. And I wanted this experience for her. And it was something fairly new in Coco's experience. And I am convinced it became part of her view of the world. She talked about it and clearly thought about it. She's still talking about the cousins and the experience a week later. My son recently messaged me that Coco just said, when Sophia gives me a hug, I close my eyes. And when Eliza gives me a hug, I close my eyes because they hug me so tight and I hug them so tight too. Yeah. I add this story partly as a doting grandma and partly as a reminder that it's important not only to work on and accept the negative things, but to celebrate and absorb the lessons of positive things too. Roberts reminded students that Socrates said, the unexamined life is not worth living. I think we can include notable good experiences as well as the ones that we call learning experiences. The important thing is to examine them.
My grade school library was 2 classrooms wide with a circulation desk in the middle. One half was full of picture books and a large carpeted area for story time. The other half was full of bookshelf-lined nooks surrounding an area with library tables. The shelves were arranged so that we could start at one end, move in and out of the nooks looking at the books until we reached the other end. As a voracious reader, I scanned those shelves weekly for the next volume that interested me. Although I didn't read all the books in the library, I became familiar with the authors, titles, and subject areas. I had a pretty good handle on the body of knowledge that was available there. I also grew up in a home that had a lot of books. My parents were one of the tens of thousands of households that had purchased the series of the great books of the Western world from door-to-door salesmen back in the early 1960s. This 54-volume series was a project of the University of Chicago to offer the benefits of a classical education first to businessmen and later to the rising middle class. Texts included those of the ancient Greeks, medieval classics such as Dante and the Canterbury Tales, works from the Renaissance and Enlightenment, all the way up to the beginning of the 20th century with writings from William James and Sigmund Freud. My father was an immigrant who had just started his career as a school teacher, and my mother came from a poor working class family. So these books were seen as a path into the new middle class culture that they were moving into on the right side of the tracks. Later, I went to college at State University. I quickly became aware that there was a lot of knowledge, really important knowledge, that I only did not know. I wasn't even aware that it existed. Instead of a single library room, There were multiple library buildings, each with multiple floors and multiple rooms of books. I could read my whole life. I could walk around all those stacks of books, but I could never have a good handle on this wider body of knowledge. But still, there seemed to be a body of knowledge, finite and commonly held, as a rich narrative of civilization and its ever-progressing achievements. Since then, I have experienced a gradual shift in awareness and understanding about knowledge and our relationship to it. I've come to realize that the cohesive narrative of civilization that I was exposed to through the Great Book series was really a narrative of white Western civilization informed by the Enlightenment. What was labeled as serious fiction by critics like Harold Bloom was mostly white male fiction. Usually there was a powerful or at least an interesting white male main character having uniquely white male experiences as individuals. Captain Ahab versus Moby Dick. Tom Joad trying to survive the Dust Bowl. Jack Kerouac hitchhiking across the country. I don't see myself in any of those stories, really. I'm also beginning to understand some of the implications of quantum physics and some of the related shifts in human understanding has us looking not at individual, discrete bits of matter, but in the relationship and interactions between them. Instead of trying to reduce complicated organisms and organizations into their component parts, we now know that we need to understand complicated organisms and organizations holistically. How they exist in their organic relationships affects their properties. About 100 years ago, mathematicians like Alfred North Whitehead and philosophers like William James began to look at the world in terms of process and relationship, rather than in terms of individual objects and people. More recently, sociologists began to study how humans interact in systems of relationships, from the emotional family systems theory studied and put forth by Murray Bowen, to a more general series of systems by Ludwig von Bertalanffy. In the past few decades, organizational psychologists and sociologists have been developing new mental models that are based on different kinds of systems theory. I've recently made the connection between the brilliance of system theory and how we might move from a culture that is still dominated by the white male experience, even in supposedly enlightened places like Silicon Valley. We are still living with the myth of the single male hero or genius having all of the answers. That's what people voted for in November, and that's why certain software engineers get away with sexual harassment, because they're the genius that the organization needs. I think that Unitarian Universalism is on the right path. We've nodded to systems theory with our seventh principle, the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. But we still have many markers of the old, and may I say dying, dominant culture. A culture of extreme individualism will no longer serve humanity. We need an ethical and theological understanding based on the common good, rather than on I've got mine or might makes right. The good news is that we have models of ethics that are based in interconnection and interdependence right under our noses. You see, many other non-white cultures already have an ethos of interconnection and interdependence. Leaders used to white male culture can learn much from what leadership looks like in other cultures. You might have heard of Sankofa, which is symbolized by a bird whose feet are firmly planted going forward, but whose head is turned looking to the past. So it's learning from the past and seeing how it might inform our future. You might have also heard of the Maasai warrior greeting, which asks, how are the children? Because how the children are doing really gives you a marker of how the community is doing as a whole. So this is an idea of going from the me to the we, to really how we are doing is not how you are doing, how is the community doing, is what the questions we ask. You might have also heard of the Native American notion of seventh generation, where you don't make a decision until you think about how this is going to impact seven generations down the road. Wouldn't that be interesting if that ethos was used in the boardrooms of our oil and gas companies? Hispanic cultures have a ethos of a spirit of hospitality, which is the ethos of mi casa es su casa. So in hospitality, how do we make sure that all are welcome and included in our communities and our decision making? There's other ethoses of the leader being a leader among equals, which would have been the leaders in the story of the people of the wind, where the leaders are there to convene the people to figure things out for themselves rather than to make all the decisions. There's also this notion as a leader being the guardian of public values rather than just the guardian of whatever they think is the right way to do things. So the leaders who articulate what's best for our community. So William J. Barber, the Reverend Dr. William J. Barber of the Moral Mondays is that kind of leader. There's also leaders who are community stewards. We have those leaders in our congregation leading our Green Sanctuary movement, right? It's what's best for the world as a whole. And there's also a ethos of gracias, which is gratitude, hope, and forgiving. So there's this open-heartedness of how do we lead with our hearts open, with gratitude for what we have, with a spirit of generosity, rather than what I'm trying to protect or what I'm trying to, my stockholders, maybe. And instead of thinking about that is how can we be grateful for the gifts that we're given and how can we be good stewards of those gifts in a way that serves the whole. So along with learning about these different models of leadership, I've also developed a growing awareness of the beauty and depth of fiction writers who are women and people of color. Beyond their aesthetic appeal, their works have informed my life in profound ways, especially in developing my own embodied sense of interdependence. Recently, I reread Octavia Butler's books, The Parable of the Sower and The Parable of the Talents. And during this recent reading, I had an aha moment. The main character, her name's Lauren Oya Olamina, throughout the books, describes a new religion called Earthseed. So this is a religion that it's the truth as she talks about it, and she writes down these verses to reflect her understanding of how the world is organized and how humans need to be in response to the world. And the body of work that she creates is called Earthseed, the Books of the Living. And the books are the story of her going through a lot of trouble in sort of this dystopian future, but also giving a path for hope in humans living in concordance with her religion, Earthseed. And so she asks, in Earthseed, the religion encourages human to learn how to be adaptive, not as individuals, but as communities. And I have a piece of the scripture with wisdom that explains this. So one of the verses is, all successful life is adaptable, opportunistic, tenacious, interconnected, and fecund. Understand this, use it, shape God. Butler also describes a great turning as she imagines what will happen when humans start interstellar travel to find new worlds and create new communities. And so her idea of Earthseed is a guide for those communities. So as humans leave Earth, they're going to be faced with challenges. And humans learn best, just like we learned from John Roberts, humans learn best when they're challenged. And so this verse speaks to that future. We are Earthseed. We are flesh, self-aware, questing, problem-solving flesh. We are that aspect of earth life best able to shape God knowingly. We are earth life maturing, earth life preparing to fall away from the parent world. We are earth life preparing to take root in new ground. Earth life fulfilling its promise, its purpose, and its destiny. My aha was that in our old forms of community, or our current forms of community, based on domination-based white male ethos. This understanding has an implicit assumption about the intelligence of the dominated. Historically, women and people of color were thought to lack self-awareness, emotional self-control, and creative intelligence. Think of the word hysterical, for example. So that these people, the people who lack self-awareness, needed to be either cared for or controlled by those in society who did hold these qualities. So we had a narrative of one segment of society had the self-control and self-awareness, this other segment of society didn't, and so they were less than and needed to be subdued or subjugated to this more able part of our species. And especially usually being white males. So this continues on, even when our experiences show us that people of color and women may have a different framework in which they understand the world, but they have no less ability for self-awareness, self-control, or creative intelligence. And again, we see this in Silicon Valley. We know that women engineers are just as smart as the male engineers, and yet they're not trusted in the same way that the male engineers are in many organizations. Not all, but many organizations. So let's make the leap from groups or from individuals to groups or systems of people. Systems theory, applied by thought leaders like Peter Senge, Otto Schwarmer, and Margaret Wheatley, shows us that when organized in certain ways, human groups can develop their own kind of self-awareness, emotional control, and creative intelligence. This is the core of the work that I and my UUA congregational life colleagues do, working with congregations. We may work with and train individual leaders, but it's really in service to promoting the self-awareness of a whole congregation as a system. Discerning and living into a shared mission and vision is part of bringing in a certain kind of consciousness in the form of purpose to the congregational system. Developing and living into a covenant creates an opportunity for group emotional self-control for a system. Shared ministry, when done well, provides opportunities for creative intelligence, which I firmly believe will make the difference between congregations that will thrive in the next decades and those that will decline to the point where they need to shut their doors. An example of creative intelligence process that we have in our own community is our Hogwarts program. The way that program is formed, the individual people who lead it bring their creativity each time that they do a new Hogwarts. And that's what's kept that program fresh over a decade of time of all these adults offering it. So I think of that as a beautiful example of how creative intelligence of a group can work and sustain a group going for years and years and years. So the problem is Unitarian Universalism has inherited a strong leader model. And when under stress, it's human nature to look for some hero to fix things or to come up with the answers so that strong hero model continues, because often our congregations are under stress. But the problem with today's stresses is that they have complex and interconnected causes, and we need complex and interconnected solutions that can only come, and I repeat, only come from the collective intelligence of a creative community, willing to take chances, willing to experiment and fail being all of part of the same process, and to have the perseverance and tenacity to keep trying until we find something that works. One of my UUA colleagues has just written a white paper about Sunday school called The End of Sunday School. This just came out last month. And this is an example of an experifail. They've been looking at different ways. In New England, Sunday school's dead. The model's just not working anymore. And they've been trying different things, full week faith and some other models. And they're basically saying, we're going to just burn the whole thing down and start from scratch. And that's what they're doing, they're talking about doing in New England. Again, they have a different demographic than we do in the Midwest. But so that's an example of experifail. That's what they've been doing in our New England region. So this systems understanding and work that I describe is something that we need to encourage our leaders to pursue. We don't want to continue to train our leaders in General Motors style of management. We need to really have more creative kinds of management and managers that and leaders that help us develop our own interconnection and interdependence. So in order to move liberal faith in this direction, I invite our congregations and other covenanting communities to add a few tenets. And I use the tenets loosely. We don't really have tenets or dogmas, Unitarian Universalists, but we do have guiding principles. But the words principles was already used up, so I'm going to use the word tenets. And these are adapted from this the five smooth stones of liberal religion that our theologian James Luther Adams came up with a few decades ago. And that could be a whole other sermon, but I want to just give you the nuggets of what those are. And I say that we use these in addition to the seven principles that we already have in our spiritual backpack. These are different ways of looking at what it means to be a religious liberal. So the first tenet is that all of our relationships need to be mutual, and every single one of us deserves and needs the chance to flourish. So we should imagine communities where we give opportunity, we make opportunities for each person to find what their gifts is, find important ways to serve. And this also means that things like bullying, harassment, scorn, ostracism, humiliation have no place in human relationships. The second is that we should always be open to new learning and new ways of thinking. We should always be able to say, okay, let's step back. We've been doing this for a while. Let's step back and think about what we're going to do. So again, that was our story today, the people of the stone and the people of the wind. We want to be able to say, maybe stone isn't working for us anymore. Or maybe these structures, even though loosely built, maybe we really need to rethink how we're doing that. The third is that we should be in constant dialogue and discernment with one another to check our thinking and to get other points of view, or to hear other experiences, especially with those who have a very different way of looking at the world. And so this goes back to, I was an engineer in my first career, and I would often be recruited by companies who knew this because they wanted to have women engineers because they just come at problems differently. They want to have engineers from different ethnic backgrounds because, again, they approach problems differently. And you know, just like the tale of the blind men and the elephant, each one of us has a little different way of looking at things. And when we come together, we can get a much better picture of what's happening, or we can come up with different ways of approaching a problem so that we can come up with a solution, especially with really complicated problems. And for me, this is the theological foundation for our anti-racist, multicultural work. We need to be a community that includes all, because we need all of us to figure out how we're going to be as a community going forward. The fourth is that we should never use coercion in our interactions or relationships, although we can use persuasion and encouragement to help one another to contribute to the good of the whole. And the fifth is that we are obligated to work for a world where all of these tenets are practiced. These tenets are aspirational. They call us to be our best selves. And yet, we are fallible humans. We often fail to achieve our highest aspirations. For those of you who are heading to Summer Institute, our region's summer camp, family summer camp, you'll be learning about restorative practices, which I believe is a way for our congregations to find healing as a system after the trauma of a conflict or other disruption. The criminal justice system in our wider culture is steeped in a strong leader, strong punishment way of looking at human interaction and fragility. Restorative practices invite us into a way of community that practices faithful ways of engaging with conflict, that empowers those who are involved and impacted by the conflict to be part of both the resolution and restoration. And we'll be offering similar trainings to congregations. We think that this is, along with mission, vision, and covenant, this is another tool that our congregations need to operate as a sort of intelligent, self-reflective system that's also self-healing. I believe that faith communities like this one are labs or incubators for Western humanity's emerging awareness that we are not just self-contained, independent humans, but we are humans in relationship, and we can become conscious and active in shaping our small communities in the same way that we can shape our own selves. We can develop and disperse the DNA of a new kind of interdependent organizational system to displace the General Motors model of top-down organization in kind of a bone marrow transplant. This is where I find my hope for the brokenness of this world. Maybe it can be yours as well. Amen, and blessed be. May we become that faith community who is able, that is able to reflect upon itself, that is able to grow, that is able to teach the world how to be a better place. Amen. Blessed be. Go in peace.